Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and I want to apologize for last week. I am on the road, and last week at the last minute, the guest had to cancel for a family situation. So I do apologize to everyone out there for not, you know, having a show last week. And this week, we have Kevin Randall. Always love having him on the show to get the square scoop of what's happening around out there and has happened and all that. It's always really great to talk to him. And before that, I have Alejandro Rojas coming up with UFO updates. And I do want to thank everyone that supports the show. We couldn't do it without you. And I'm here solo with a little tiny computer down in Florida, and I hope that I'm not going to mess too many things up. I'll do my best that I can. And Alejandro, welcome to the show.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me. Is that why you're orange?
I am orange today. Yeah. Yeah.
Was that on purpose or is that just another?
No, it's the sunshine state. I'm in, Luke. You know, orange.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay, great.
No, actually, yeah, it's just the camera. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. Well.
So, yes, I'm doing well. And I hope you're having a great time. I hear that the weather is finally, you have the advantage over me. You've got the sun and the heat, whereas I'm freezing in 60-degree temperature.
Oh, 60, you poor thing. Well, it was 90 today. To me, that's a little too warm. That's, you know, it's going to be 7 degrees where I live up in Maine tomorrow. So, yeah, I feel so lucky to escape that. So, what's going on in the UFO world?
Well, there's always a lot going on. So there's a couple interesting stories here that I wanted to mention. One of them, Nick Pope posted, although he's living here in the U.S., it's kind of his neck of the woods out there in the U.K. And I'm going to, and I didn't learn, even though you and I had talked about this earlier, I didn't go educate myself on how to say the names of these cities like I should have. But the headline is, and this is from a paper called the Gloucestershire Live. And actually, this is a paper that I refer to often because, you know, the UK, just like the US, in these local papers, they write about UFO stories and happenings in their areas quite a bit. And these guys write about different sightings once in a while as well. This one is a sighting over the M5, which is a highway that was headed towards the town of Bristol. And it was seen and reported by pilots. So, very interesting case. It essentially was three orange orbs, but what's cool about this is Air Midwest actually tweeted about it. They wrote, there has been a lot of interest in the fact that our pilots observed UFOs last night during night flying exercises, so here's a brief summary of the situation. They posted this on February 15th. The sighting was on February 14th, but essentially they said last night at about 10 p.m., south of Gloucestershire, there were airborne unidentified lights. So they talk about those a little bit, just that they were moving very fast. They sent planes on an intercept course, but they couldn't catch whatever it was. Now, these weren't jet fighters. I think these were just regular commercial aircraft. But there's also in this article on Gloucestershire Live, an account from one of the pilots who just said he saw two large square orange lights, one on top of the other. They looked very strange to him. He did not believe they were balloons because of how fast that they moved. So this is a new kind of ongoing case in the media in the UK. That's pretty interesting.
Well, we actually have someone in the chat room that's actually from Gloucestershire. And that's, well, I just said it the way it's supposed to be pronounced, Gloucestershire. According to him, he did it phonically. In the chat room. Isn't that nice?
That's very nice. Thank you, Gloucestershire.
Yeah.
And Gloucestershire. I got to get that because I reference this town quite a bit because they have so many UFO sightings. And so that is great story.
Yeah.
Just because we pronounce it correctly doesn't necessarily mean, though, that people are going to be able to find it when they look out there. But you can find it in my social media, or I guess I could spell it real quickly. It's Gloucester is the name of the city.
So if you put Ire,
yeah, if you get the whole name, but yeah. If you put Gloucestershire UFO, you'll find this story out there. If right. You're opposed to going to my social media, so that's the first story of the day. Second one, this is kind of interesting. Mensa, writing about To the Stars and Lou Elizondo and the whole A-Tip situation. So it's very interesting. Menta, of course, is the intelligent, you know, organization. It's a club for people whose IQs are over, I think, 124 or 142. I can't remember exactly which one it is. Their tagline is where brilliance belong. They're not shy about being proud of their higher IQs. But they wrote about this case in a very straightforward way. They kind of just talk about how, you know, there's been mysteries in science before, and now there are scientists, incredible people, tackling this issue now. That this was kind of all brought together by Tom DeLonge, and that they have this Atom Project where they're looking at materials that they have obtained that they believe may be anomalous. But in particular, they do get a quote from someone we haven't heard from that often that's part of the To the Stars group, and that's Steve Justice. He is formerly of Lockheed Skunk Works, and Skunk Works is a team that created, you know, the F-22 Raptor, the F-35 Lightning, the stealth planes, the U-2, the SR-71. Much of this developed at Area 51. They're the guys who built and were in charge of Area 51. A lot of that craft was inspired by the CIA or projects that were CIA-sponsored. But that also, of course, bled over to Air Force and other organizations. But it's incredible that we have this guy with Skunk Works who is working on UFO projects. One of his quotes that I liked, he said, "To the Stars is a group of people who came together to answer the questions that most of society is afraid to ask. There's this overwhelming body of evidence that indicates something strange is going on." So essentially making the argument that UFOs are a worthwhile study. So really interesting. And then one more thing that's kind of along the lines is about A-Tip and Lou Elizondo is that that organization, in this Mensa article, they mentioned that A-Tip no longer exists, that it went from 2007 to 2012. However, according to Lou, that is not the case. The organization still does exist. In fact, he said that in the New York Times, but for whatever reason, the Mensa article didn't allude to that. The DOD did say that funding was pulled in 2012. However, there's a gentleman, Danny Silver, who's got a website called Silver Record, and it's pretty good. He's been following all of this stuff, and he wrote an article recently called A-Tip Did Not End, and essentially he goes over all of the quotes and information around how A-Tip still exists. And Lou told me, and this is a really, I think, pretty interesting, he told me not only does it continue, but that who the people who are running it are very high level. He talked about kind of some of the ranks, but yeah, very, very high level individuals that are still involved with A-Tip. And, you know, it's been debated, but the key players and the people who not only worked on the program, but also started it have claimed, you know, UFOs were a big part of this program, looking into UFO phenomena, including, and their example was the USS Nimitz situation. So, yeah. So
great stuff.
Interesting things going on.
That is something. It's just, you know, I wonder what it would be so nice to know what Lou knows. You know.
Yes, it would.
As far as like who's running it and all that, and you know what more information. You know, it would be great if we had all the scoop, and it seems like we may be getting it slow. You know, spoon fed a little bit here and there, possibly. Mm-hmm. And you you told me earlier today that you know Lou was going to be on your show, and had to call it off for a couple weeks, and he's involved in something, but you're actually going to be interviewing him fairly in the next few weeks, right?
Yeah, so he can't do any media interviews for a few weeks. However, luckily before that, I am already planning to meet him one-on-one, a meeting we had already pre-planned. So he said that he'll give me a little bit of information, a little bit more that, and some that can be shared when we do meet. And then once he's cleared to do interviews, he'll be able to share a lot more about like the current project. Someone had mentioned before, Tom DeLonge tweeted that they had some sort of, you know, findings with the Atom Project that they'll be able to share in the future. So we'll be able to get a lot more information out in a few weeks. So, and this project that has, you know, essentially delayed him being able to do my interview has also delayed the release of information for quite some time. So they're very excited to be able to share a lot more about what they've been up to in the last few months. Now, some people complain, oh, since they started, they made so much promises, but we haven't heard much. But you got to remember, it takes a long time to investigate this stuff, especially if you're dealing with materials where you have to get things analyzed and then that the analysis, the data to be analyzed by another third party. So it takes a lot of time to do this. In fact, the SEU, which we talked about earlier, and Kevin Randall's a part of that, the Scientific Coalition for Ufology, those guys came out with their Aguadilla report. It took them 2 years to research that and come out with that report. So,
wow.
You know, I would argue that it hasn't been that, you know, we've gotten quite a bit in this year or so. But it sounds like there's a lot more information to come.
Yeah, yeah, exciting. This could be the year. Of course, they've been saying that for, you know, 70 years. But anyway.
But you know what? You would be right the last couple of years. 2017, we found out about the Pentagon Project, or at least, you know, and who the star started. Last year, we found out tons more about it. So each year, 2017, 2018, and have been banner years for this field. And it seems like 2019 will follow up with that.
It sure could happen. Hey, mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Alejandro.
All right, thank you, and I'll see you in Roswell, Kevin.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right, I'm getting ready to bring him in. All right, everyone, so hang in there. Just 1 second. Something's not working here. Hmm. Okay, OBS troubles. Anyway, Alejandro, thank you, and we'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you later.
All right. All right, so my guest... been on the show many, many times. Kevin Randall, he is a very prominent figure in, for those of you who are new listeners in the UFO community. He's written over 80 books. I can't even remember how many books he's written. We'll talk a little bit about that. He was one of the first people in there investigating the Roswell incident. He's been writing lately. He's got the go-to blog, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to UFOs and getting the straight scoop. There's many times that I actually go to his blog to understand something that I'm a little confused about, which is quite often. And it's always a pleasure to have him on the show. Welcome, Kevin.
I hate to correct you at the very beginning of your show.
Well, I think you did that last time, so I'm used to it.
Oh, okay. But I don't know why we're still hung up on this 80 books thing.
No, I said that information I said at is like, least...
Yes, well, that 80 books was like 2 decades ago. It's like 125 now, so.
All right, well, you got to get someone in there to change your Wikipedia page. I think that's what it's all about, maybe.
Oh, well,
that's
there you go.
That's where the information is. Yeah. Wow. So do you ever take any time off?
Yes.
Yeah.
And most of the time, I'm out snow blowing the driveway because.
Oh, yeah.
We're in the cold weather. You're at 90 degrees. We'll be lucky. We'll be about 1-2 below zero tonight.
Ah, wow. Yikes. Well, that's only temporarily. I have to go back to the snow soon. But anyway, so, Kevin, let's see. I think it's been – I think you were on last July or something like that. I can't remember exactly when. And so there's always something happening. And I see that lately you've been writing your opinion on – the new Project Blue Book, History Channel's Project Blue Book, and interviewing, you know, certain people involved in that, including Paul Hynek, and also someone involved with the that was also involved in creating the show, right?
Well, the guy is the senior vice president for Arts and Entertainment Network, which owns History Channel. So.
I see, right. Okay.
He's a senior vice president for scripted shows, so he was kind of one of the big wheels in getting the program to the air, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So what do you, you know, I personally really like the show. I know that it's, you know, there's a lot of people grumbling in the UFO community because of the facts aren't exactly, you know, it's a show based on, you know, it says based on the truth, but sometimes it's a little bit loose. And people are, you know, people that are the hardcore UFO people that want the straight scoop are a little bit upset about that. But what is your philosophy in general about how it's going?
I tuned in, I think, the first week to hate it. and got sucked into it and realized that if you can separate the drama from the fact, and it's when you say it's based on real events, it's really loosely based on real events. But if you can separate the two things, that this is a drama, they're not making a documentary, and just get into it, then I find it quite enjoyable. And one of the questions that came up first was, I wondered how J. Allen Hynek would have felt by the way he's portrayed in the program. And my thought says, well, there's Hynek kids. What do they think? And I got in touch with Paul Hynek to ask him. And he said, well, my dad would have liked the show. He'd have probably got himself a big bowl of popcorn, put his feet up and watched the show and had a great time with it. So I'm thinking if the Hynek family is on board with the program, I can't dislike it because of the way Hynek is portrayed in the program, because the family doesn't mind. Yeah, I mean, I could pick it apart, and I've done a little bit of that. The military stuff is really horrendously portrayed. They don't know how to salute. They don't understand military protocol. They don't understand how things developed in the military. All of that stuff, which you could fix without spending any money at all.
Yeah, just a consultant.
In fact, I told Arturo Intarian, he's the senior vice president for Scripted Program. I told him when I had him on my show that the general in it was wearing a Air Force Commendation Medal. And I said that didn't come into being until 1958. So he shouldn't be wearing that medal. And I'm thinking, I'm probably like one of three people that would have caught that.
I'm kind of, it's kind of difficult for people to watch, you know, any vintage show with me, because I'm an appraiser, and I'm always looking for, you know, mistakes in movies. I do this all the time. It's just a bad habit. And their sets are pretty good. I mean, they're doing pretty well, you know, as far as dating the vintage for everything else. But, you know, I'm surprised that they don't have an exact, as far as consulting goes, when you're telling me all these different things in the military, they must have some type of advisor, but they're missing some things, it sounds like.
But it's really not them. It's everybody in Hollywood doesn't understand military protocol. They don't understand when you salute. They don't understand the general, for example. Military protocol says you don't refer to a general as sir, you call him general. Most people in the military, when they're addressing a general, they will say sir. I always went out of my way to say general to them and see if anybody would get mad at me about that. But I mean, if you haven't been in the military, spend time in the military, some of these things are very hard to understand. The protocol for saluting, for example, you don't salute on the flight line. Why? Because there's a lot of dangerous stuff going on the flight line, and you don't wear your cover on the flight line, meaning your hat. You don't wear it on the flight line because they blow off and get sucked into the engines and blow them up.
Yep.
So there's all these little things like that. But on the other side, when you look at it from a perspective of having served in the military, some people do that sort of thing. They don't understand. They're new to the military, or they forget about it, or they're not used to being around the aircraft and that sort of thing. You know, there were things we did as a pilot, we did that. The best example is I was a warrant officer, which is a rank between the top-ranking sergeants and lowest officers. And one day, my co-pilot was the first lieutenant. Well, on the ground, he outranked me. But in the aircraft, I outranked him. We were flying a colonel around to check on various fire support bases. And the colonel refused to talk to me. He would talk to the first lieutenant. And the lieutenant would point to me and says, he's the aircraft commander. You've got to tell him. And so, I mean, that's kind of something that is a little bit bizarre to aviation, where you would have the junior officer actually being the aircraft commander and the more senior officer being the co-pilot. And at one point, we landed outside a fire support base, and I wasn't going to stay out there with the aircraft because we were outside the wire, and I wasn't a safe place to be. So we walked inside. We had the guy's sergeant major with us, and he saw the colonel walking to the aircraft. He said, we got to hurry, or the colonel's going to the aircraft. And I said, he's not going any place without us. So, you know, that sort of thing, you know, I look for that, but I understand that Hollywood just doesn't get it. So I suggested to him they find a military consultant, and it wouldn't really have to be somebody that was there all the time. They could do it via Skype, call the guy and says, is this a uniform set up properly, and that sort of thing.
I wouldn't be surprised. And for the people that don't know this, they just got an okay for season two. So
yes,
it's going to be going another season. So those and out there that hate it are going to have to hate it a little more.
Well, the other thing he pointed out is they didn't know how long the show was going to last, meaning they were going to go for 10 episodes. But if they expanded beyond that, then there were things they could do. But they didn't know that. So when they began, they have a character named Quinn, and he's sort of an Ed Ruppelt type guy. And the way it was explained to me, he said, but we didn't know where we were going to go on. And if we had Ruppelt in there at the beginning, and then, of course, he was only there for a short time, then we move into, like, Snyder, and I forget the other guy's name, who were rabidly anti-UFO and or lackadaisical in the job, so they didn't care. So they created this Quinn guy to kind of take the role of the Air Force officer running the, because they're all over the time frame as well. Run the Air Force end of it. And then, of course, Hynek started at the very beginning and goes up into the 1960s with his consulting work with Project Blue Book. But like I said, the other thing I remember is growing up as a kid, my mother told me that George Custer had been promoted to Brigadier General by mistake. And if you go back and you read the Civil War history, you understand, no, he wasn't promoted by mistake, that the Academy graduates, as the Federal Army expanded with all these volunteer and militia regiments that were brought in from the states regiments, they were putting active duty officers in charge. And so I think Custer had been a captain, and they appointed him in charge of the Michigan Brigade, which called for a brigadier general. So he was promoted to brigadier general because he was now the commander of the Michigan Brigade. Oh. The idea that he was promoted by mistake comes from the movie They Died With Their Boots On. Huh. And there was the idea was the Michigan. Well, Custer had taken a horse in the show, and they were starting a letter to him, you know, to Captain Custer, you know, you took the horse, bring it back, and they didn't get that far, and they said, we need a brigadier from the Michigan Brigade. So it's the guy just picked up a piece of paper and started writing on it, and the adjutant signed it, and it was to Custer. So he became a brigadier general by mistake, but that's really not the way it happened in real, honest to goodness history.
Yeah.
So I mean, but the point is, you look at the stories that you see on television, you see, or the movies, and they're based on real events. They compress it. They combine characters. They switch events around. So it's a much more dramatic thing. And if you look at the Project Blue Book show, you notice they go from like 1948 with the Gorman sighting to 1951, which was the Lubbock Lights. I think they did, the Flatwood Monster, 1952. Then they're right back into 1948. So their timeline, if you're following the timeline, it doesn't work. But there's all events that had to do with Project Blue Book or the official Air Force investigations. You look at all of that sort of thing, and you're looking at a drama as opposed to a documentary, and you have to keep that in mind. And I think the people who are really annoyed about the program were looking for a documentary as opposed to a drama.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I'm getting out of it as well. And we're going to run to break here. And so this is Martin Willis. My guest tonight is Kevin Randall, and we will be right back. All right, we are back, and my guest is Kevin Randall, and we are talking Project Blue Book. So, Kevin, about the people getting the bits and pieces of a real story, and I noticed on your website you go into the details of certain stories. Do you think that this is in a way also a good thing, that because my personality is, if I watch something on TV or a movie or wherever I watch it, I like to do research if I'm really interested in the topic and interested in what actually happened. Anytime I see something that's based on fact, I want to know the facts, so I do all my research, and I love doing that. I don't know if anyone else is like me. But do you think overall that people are going to be out there, looking into what really happened in these cases?
I put up on my blog, www.kevinrendall.blogspot.com. I snuck it in there. I it's the story. You can figure out what case they're really talking about, even though they don't You know, like the Gorman dogfight, that was, they called it the Fuller. Fuller was the name of the pilot. And so I put up on my blog the real facts as it developed out of that specific case. And some of the explanations have gone longer, but I know that people have come to the blog to look at that and get the story as it truly transpired. And I think that's one of the things I thought was a good thing for it. It gets people interested in UFOs. And I'm the same way. If I see something on television or I read something like that, I go to various sources to see if I can figure out what the real story is and where we are on that. So I think we're bringing people into the UFO field who may not have been interested and say, well, this is based on real facts. What are the real facts? And if they look at it, the end of the program, they take like 30 seconds to give you some of the real facts. But if you don't catch that, and it's very, very minimal what you get. So if you type in Lubbock Lights, for example, I think you come to my blog or you go to a lot of other sites that can give you a more expanded explanation of what the Lubbock Lights case was really all about. So I think it's a good thing that they are able to interest people in ufology who may not have taken an interest in it before the program aired. And we should make a point here that when we say Project Blue Book, we're talking about the television series as opposed to the actual Air Force investigation, which was also cleverly called Project Blue Book. So, you know, there is a distinction there.
Right, right. And when Project Blue Book ended as far as we know, you know, there's bits and pieces of the files out there. Does anyone happen to know, or do you happen to know if there's if they destroyed a lot of their files or perhaps are archived somewhere? Do you know any of that situation?
I know everything.
That's why you're in the show. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. what happened is, as they were cleaning out the offices in 1969, I interviewed a guy named Carmen Morano, who was technically the last officer in charge of Blue Book, and it kind of devolved to him. He was a first lieutenant, and his job was to get rid of the stuff, and he thought a lot of it should be saved. So he saved it himself. They did put it together into an archive. It went to Maxwell Air Force Base, which was the Air Force Archives was there at one point, and it probably still there. And then it went to the National Archives. What happened was they had all of this material. Jack Webb was going to do a program called Project UFO, which is essentially Project Blue Book, and he paid to have the files microfilmed. So Air Force officers went through them and took out the names of everybody. It redacted an awful lot of the stuff. I had been to the Project Blue Book files at Maxwell Air Force Base right after they released, and that hadn't happened yet. Files weren't redacted. One of the things that Bob Cornett, I'd gone down there with a friend of mine, Bob Cornett, and I did was we wrote down all the cases, all the unidentifieds with the names. We could put the names back into the unidentified cases. If you look at the case files on some of the cases, there'll be newspaper clippings at the end. Those weren't redacted, so you could put the names back there. And the best one I saw was they had done an interview with Kenneth Arnold about his sighting. Mm-hmm. It was a telephone interview, and they had the initials of the officer and Kenneth Arnold, K.A. They'd gone through, and they had crossed out all the K.A.s throughout the entire transcript. And on the front page, in letters that had to be a half inch high grease pencil, it said Arnold case. So you knew what it was all about.
Right.
The point simply is to answer your question. Yeah, the stuff was saved. Carmen Morano saved a lot of stuff that was not classified that had been used by various individuals in desk drawers as opposed to the official filing cabinets. The stuff has all been microfilmed. You can find it on the internet. I've got a complete set of the microfilms, and I've got pretty much the whole thing on digital copy as well, so I can search stuff pretty easily. Fold 3 has the stuff there. Fold 3 is a history site. You can join for free and access the Project Blue Book files because they're public record, so you can access them. So you can see a lot of the stuff. So the stuff is there. Morano, the interesting story, a guy named Rob Mercer would go to Craigslist to look to see if anybody put any UFO stuff up. And he found somebody who was selling a box of Project Blue Book material, and he spent the $100 to see what it was. And it was most of the files, duplicate files, of the Lonnie Zamora sighting from Socorro of 1964. Mm-hmm. And he... talked to the guy who'd found the box. He said the guy had said, "Well, I was at a garage sale. I was buying this wood. I paid him that. They told me to clean it out, and I came to this box of UFO stuff." And they didn't know who belonged to or anything else, so he put it up on eBay. Mercer bought it. Mercer, through a wonderful piece of detective work, was able to trace the box back to the house, learned who owned the house, which was Carmen Morano, the last guy to be in charge of Project Blue Book, traced him to his home and talked to him and found out there was additional stuff that Morano had saved, hadn't looked at it in decades. And he says, "You can have it if you want." So Mercer got all of this stuff. But the interesting thing is, so you can compare the, I guess you can say, sort of the unofficial documents from Blue Book with the official files and see where there are gaps and where there are changes and things like that. But it's a long-winded to say, yeah, the Project Blue Book stuff exists. And I think most of it exists. I don't think they got rid of a lot of it. They got rid of some of the stuff in the beginning. We know, based on correspondence, we know based on testimony, for example, that in 1946, 1947, the U.S. government, the U.S. military, was interested in the ghost rockets over Scandinavia. Mm. And they gathered a lot of that material. It does not appear in the Project Blue Book files, although there are references to it in the Blue Book files. So at some point, they took out and destroyed all that material about the ghost rockets. And this was done probably early on in the investigation. There are other things. There are cases referenced in the final reports of Sign and Grudge, but the cases aren't in the Project Blue Book files, and there's nothing about them in the Blue Book files, yet they're referenced in the Grudge reports. So you know there were documents created about that, and the documents have since disappeared. And if you go through the index of Project Blue Book, there's any... especially in the beginning, there's a lot of files that say case missing, case missing, case missing. So at some point, they had cleaned the files out to purge them, and that material is gone forever. Although there's hints to where the case was and the date of the case, so we can kind of go back and put some of that stuff together.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the, I think it would be kind of fun to do this one thing for the listener out there that actually watched the show on, say, the Flatwoods Monster, and talk about the differences. I know that you wrote a blog about this, so if you wouldn't mind, touch on some of the differences between what the show portrayed and what actually happened.
Well, the one thing that bothered me most about that was that you seem to have the townspeople up in arms, like the farmers or the townspeople in the Frankenstein movie. You know, they got their torches and their pitchforks, and they're storming the castle because Dr. Frankenstein has created this monster. And you get this sort of idea in the Flatwoods case that the people are there with their shotguns and they're really annoyed about the story of the monster. Well, that never really happened. The townspeople did come to Kathleen May's house. She was one of the people involved in seeing the thing, to talk to her. And then they went out and searched for the monster from that point. But there was no kind of conflict between the townspeople and the people who had seen the UFO. And that was the one thing that really bothered me about it. The explanation they come up with at the end, the Air Force shows, well, it's an owl with the big eyes on a tree that had been kind of burned by something. And that was kind of the Air Force explanation, and the way they showed it in the program kind of made sense because it really did sort of look like a monster, but it really was an owl in a tree. I'm not sure that that's a legitimate explanation. But they take a lot of liberties with the case. You know, they change the name of the people, obviously. I think at the end of that case, somebody committed suicide because they wouldn't listen to her. She jumped out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing. Those things didn't happen. But they're also creating a drama here. And, I thought that was a little bit over the top, but it was part of the drama. So the case was, it really didn't have the conflict between the townspeople. There was a certain amount of ridicule directed at the people that saw the UFO or the monster, that sort of thing. But you get that in any UFO case now. There's a great deal of ridicule directed at people who report that sort of thing. And you look at the mainstream media, and their idea is, and it's changing now. I see them being much more consistent with their reporting, much more accurate with their reporting. But for the longest time, it was the idea that I'm too sophisticated to believe in flying saucers, but I'll let you ramble on and then I'll make fun of you when we're done here. And you would see that in the local media doing UFO stories and that sort of thing. And the one that really cracked me up was these two guys in New Jersey tried to create a UFO sighting by attaching flares to a balloon because you wanted to believe to prove that UFO investigators and researchers were credulous and the witnesses didn't know what they talked about. And when you watch the stories as they unfolded on the TV, you'd see the witnesses actually being very credible, explaining exactly what they see. And you saw a reporter at one point saying, well, the UFO seems to be, its lights seem to be flashing. And the woman they were interviewing said, no, it was passing behind a tree and it was wintertime and at nighttime. So you didn't really see the tree, but you saw the lights blinking. And she was able to explain what that was. I thought, well, that's very good. She's explaining exactly what was going on. And these two guys were attempting to create this. But the one that got to me was the reporter going to a little girl eating a lollipop and says, what do you think about the aliens? I'm thinking, nobody said a word about aliens. Nobody said a word about anything. And you, and the person you go interview is some seven-year-old girl with a lollipop. You can't interview a UFO researcher. You can't interview the witnesses. But we can find a little girl with a lollipop and put the idea of aliens in her head. But I see we getting much more legitimate reporting now. The New York Times was very kind to the announcement about Blink 182's UFO investigation. I mean, they treated it as a legitimate story, and I see more of that going on in today's world.
Yeah. I think a lot has changed in just since the Pentagon article came out. It just seems so much more. I don't know, easy to talk about. I spent the last weekend with a on an island with a some of the friends, next door neighbor of some friends I was visiting, and he was a commercial pilot with 55,000 hours, a lot of international flights and all that. And I got up the courage to ask him if he had ever seen anything unusual. And, he basically went into a couple of near crash stories and stuff like that. But I still have, and certain mixture of companies, kind of a hard time, bringing up, hey, what do you think about UFOs? Sometimes I feel comfortable with someone and can say it. But it's still a little bit of that, that pressure not to go there.
Well, when we deployed to Iraq, I mean, almost everybody knew that I was the UFO guy. But the questions were legitimate, and they were interested in what I had to say. It wasn't anybody really making fun of what I was doing, and it might have been one of two reasons. One is because they were highly interested in what I had to say, or I was one of the senior officers in the battalion. they were a little bit intimidated by it. But one of the interesting things is, while in Iraq, we had satellite feeds, satellite television, and we got the History Channel. And a couple of the NCOs came up to me one day and wanted to know if I had a brother. And I said, why? And he said, well, we were watching this program on history the other day. And there was a guy with the same last name that looks an awful lot like you. And I said, yeah, that was me about 10 years ago. So they had seen that. But, inside that community, if somebody had a question about it, they would ask me, and I would answer the question as best I could about what UFOs were. Nobody seemed to be really taken aback by my interest in that topic. We had another guy who was very interested in NASCAR, so he became the NASCAR guy. Mm-hmm. So it was just people had an expertise that they brought to their military service, and people who were interested in it would approach them to ask questions.
Now,
but
let me just ask you this. If you were a private, do you think you would have been treated differently?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think it was just an interest in what was going on. And I think in the military, we respect those who have the knowledge, regardless of the rank that they hold. And I noticed that when we came back to the United States, there was a specialist who had worked in the Joint Operations Center for many, many years. And if there was a question about protocols, they would ask him the question. He was, an E4, very low-ranking enlisted man. And you'd have majors asking him questions about the specific protocols because he was the subject matter expert. And that's the was a kind of the big catchphrase in the military for a while. There was subject matter expert. Who's your subject matter expert? Mm-hmm. And you go to that person and ask the questions because he or she should have those answers. And the rank didn't really factor into that much because this was the person who had the answers. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the subject matter expert happened to be a major or a captain or a colonel. And sometimes it happened to be a sergeant or a specialist or a private. I don't remember any privates, but me, the specialist was the one that popped into my mind because I had seen officers asking him specific protocol questions and how to move forward in a specific task to get it done right. So, mm-hmm. And he would explain, well, here's what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of shows kind of focused on the Nimitz case, and I also have Kevin Day, who is the radar operator, coming up in a few weeks, and hopefully another witness. He said he would try to get me another witness to what was going on there. But, the military encounters, to me, are fascinating. And you being a military person, do you think that there is a lot more happening that, it seems to me now that I've had 5 or 6 military people on my show that have talked about, some type of encounter. And I don't know if, because a lot of people are out in the elements. Is that one of the reasons why they see, possibly see UFOs? Or do you think there's a connection, any type of connection with military and UFO encounters?
One thing you have to remember, if you're outside, you're probably more likely to see one than if you're inside, looking or looking down at your cell phone.
Right, yeah.
I talked to a few people that were involved in sightings, and some of them were kind of funny. I talking to a colonel about the Kinross disappearance, and the first thing he said to me is, well, let me tell you a story. And he said, we were flying up toward Canada, and we saw this glow on the horizon. We thought it was the moon coming up. And as we got closer, we realized it's not the moon because the moon was in a different part of the sky, and there was this orange glow that really bothered us. Till we got close enough, we discovered it was a forest fire. Mm. So, mm-hmm. They got to the point where, they're talking UFO, but they've got an explanation.
Right.
The other story he told me is about Kinross, and that's the F-89 that disappeared. Off radar, the object, the UFO blip and the F-89 blip merged, and everybody thought, well, they flew over it or under it, that sort of thing. But the blips never separated, and the single blip left. So what happened to the F-89? Hmm. That was 1953, and we still don't know.
Wow.
The odds are it probably went into the Lake Superior, but mm-hmm. we don't know that. And what he was telling me was that there were 2 school thoughts at Kinross at the time because he had been there. And one of them was that it was a UFO and it took them. The other school, which was probably the more prevalent school of thought, was that the airplane had crashed and gone into the lake. But he was saying that he was up in a fighter doing their thing and were approached by a UFO. It was pacing them. And he said to his wingman, okay, we're going to count to 3 and we're going to turn into it to see what happens. And I thought, well, this is really a dumb plan. But that's what their plan was. And he counted 3. They turned toward the UFO and it just sped off.
Wow.
And so you've got these guys who were at Kinross at the time, after the disappearance of the F-89, talking about another legitimate UFO sighting and what they did. They don't know what they saw or what happened. But that was what he told me. So I've talked to military pilots, military personnel who have told me their UFO stories. My own experience, no, I didn't see anything.
Yeah.
I did have a top secret clearance as an intelligence officer in the Air Force and then in the Guard when we went to Iraq. So I was seeing top secret. I could see top secret stuff. Most of the stuff we saw was classified secret. And that's the other thing. The UFO field talks about top secrets and all this stuff, and they don't understand that the difference between secret and top secret is just astronomical.
Yeah.
Secret stuff can be stored in a safe or a locking file cabinet, not a tin file cabinet, but one like that. Top secret requires a vault. You've got to sign it out. You've got to make notations where it's gone and where and when it comes back. I mean, it's very, very strict on the dealing with top secrets. In my military experience, I never saw a top secret document that dealt with UFOs. Never. Mm-hmm. I saw secret documents that did, and the sightings were pretty mundane, the kind of sightings that we get all the time, the kind of sightings that we see, pilots seeing the things, people on the ground seeing the things. I talked to people who told me their UFO stories, but it was not in any kind of official capacity. So, you know, it's just, well, that's an interesting story, and I'll just file it away in case it comes up later on. So, you know, it I think it just depends on what your mission is, where you are, what you're doing, that you happen to see these things. And I think if you look at the statistics, that you'll find out that most UFO sightings take place between like 6 p.m. at night and 10 o'clock at night. Well, why would that be? Well, there's more people outside, you know.
Yeah.
And when do you get most of the sightings? Well, you get them in the summertime. Why? More people are outside.
Yeah.
You know, in today's environment, they may be outside, but they're still staring at their damn phone.
yeah, that's
so,
right.
So they're not seeing anything. But yeah. But I think if you look at the statistics, you know, and you break them down that way, you know, it makes sense about when are you most likely to see something and what are you doing when you see it? Well, you're outside doing something. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I think I remembered in it, this was like decades ago, that somebody had analyzed it. The date you're most likely to see a UFO was, I think, April 24th. Hmm. I think the day of the week was Wednesday.
Wow.
If I remember correctly, I don't remember exactly, but it just struck me, you know. And then you start about breaking it down time. Well, it's after 6 p.m. at night. And prior to midnight, say, you see it because the people are outside looking up. So when you ask the question, I think that the reason you get the military, part of the reason you get the military pilots involved, of course, is the Air Defense Command and the requirement to check on aircraft penetrating the air defense zones around the coastal areas of the United States. So if something penetrates that and is not a commercial flight, and it's not a flight that has been logged on through the various ways you do those sorts of things like the FAA, then the Air Force scrambles to take a look at it to see what it is. Oftentimes, most times, it turns out to be a commercial aircraft that's off its course or somebody you know, didn't file the proper flight plan. When I was in flight school, I didn't know this because I was like 18 years old, but we were flying the darn TH-55, which has a service ceiling at like 12,000 feet. But you could get it higher if you worked at it. The ways you could defeat that. And I think I got up to 15,000 feet once and then came down from it. And I realized later that the FAA requires a flight plan for everybody over 14,000 feet. So I was in violation of FAA regulations unknowingly. Uh-huh. But I don't know if I came up on radar and then disappeared or what exactly happened. But I think if the radar operator knew what was going on and knew what was going on in the area, say, well, there's one of those damn helicopter students trying to see what he can do, that sort of thing. So, I mean, you look at that sort of thing. So you'd expect the military pilots to maybe see something more often. Pilots who fly late at night may see something more often because it's much easier to see the things at night than it would be during the daylight hours. You know, so hey. I don't think there's really any conspiracy going on about that. Where they're looking at the military more so than the civilian world.
Yeah. By the way, April 24th this year is on a Wednesday, so everyone ought to be outside.
After 6 p.m.
After 6 p.m., right. And speaking of helicopters, and you know, the one case I think is really intriguing is the Larry Coyne case incident back in 73 or whenever it was. A helicopter. And what do you think of that case?
First of all, I had to laugh at Philip Klass because he wrote in his book when he was degrading the case, downgrading the case, denigrating the case. He was concerned because Coyne took over the controls from, was it Jesse who was flying it? And he said, as the helicopter was going down, plunging down, and he couldn't do anything about it. And then suddenly they popped up to 3,500 feet. And Class said, well, maybe Jesse took over the collectives and pulled up on it, so that, because he could see what was going on. I said, no, not the way it works. Ah. I knew they had the same training I did. And mm-hmm. the one thing you always did, if I was a pilot in command and I wanted the co-pilot to fly, I would have my hands on the control. I'd say, you've got it. Mm-hmm. He would put his hands on the control and said, I've got it. I would release them. Mm-hmm. Or if I wanted to take control, I would say, I've got it. Put my hands on the control, he would release it. And so Jesse, who was in the other seat, wouldn't have been pulling up on the collective without informing Cone what he was doing. It just wouldn't work that way. He would have said, he would have either mentioned it to him, or he would have taken the controls, because he sees the aircraft is about to crash, and he says, I've got it. And I was inexperienced with my co-pilots as an aircraft commander in Vietnam once. The co-pilot took the aircraft away and made a dive because he thought we were about to hit another airplane.
Wow.
And he just said, I've got it. I said, you've got it, and let go of it. And he dove. And then I said, what are you doing? And he said, I thought we were going to hit that airplane. I said, no, I had it in sight. It was like, you know, half a mile away. Don't worry about it. But he just caught it, and he thought the aircraft was in danger, and he took controls. I mean, we were trained on how to do that.
Yeah.
So when Class said that Jesse had pulled up on the collective, I keep reaching down for the collective because it was with your left hand. The collective pitch, which controls up and down, it just wouldn't have happened that way. And both of them were military pilots. Both of them had been trained the same way I was, through the same flight schools. I knew exactly what was going on. But I think it's a very good case. You've got four military people. I talked to one of the guys. In fact, I had him on my radio show to talk. No, I invited him. He didn't want to do it. But I talked to him about that and what he'd seen and how things went in the aircraft. So I got a better idea. I did a thing on my blog about that and what he had seen and how that happened. Class, in his analysis, ignored one of the crewmen who'd seen the object out the left side of the aircraft as it passed by the left side, and then it came up on the right side of the aircraft, so it circled around the aircraft. So Class was completely wrong on that, but I think it's a very good case. I don't think there's a good explanation for it.
Right.
There was a fellow who said that it was an air refueling aircraft that was supposed to be air refueling a helicopter in the area, and the air refueling aircraft got too close to the helicopter. Well, you have no air refueling capability on a Huey helicopter, for one thing. And in the United States, the air refueling operations take place in certain areas. And this wasn't one of the areas where it would take place. So the explanation kind of failed on those points. But, I mean, it was a legitimate attempt to explain the sighting. He thought he had a good explanation, and he pointed out there, and we took a look at it. When I say we, I mean me, and talked to some of the people about it. We decided, well, it's an interesting theory, but I don't think it works based on the facts. So I think it's a very good case based on the testimonies by the crew member who were on board. I know Jesse's explanations were a little bit different than the rest of the crew. He didn't quite agree with some of the things they said. But you go back and you take a look at the original statements, and you find his statement is more in line with their statements as his statements later on sort of diverged from what they had to say.
Kevin, we got to go to break, and when we come back for the new listener, let's go over like a nutshell of what actually transpired during that sighting. All right, everyone, my guest tonight is Kevin Randall, and we'll be right back right after these messages. All right, we're back. My guest is Kevin Randall, and before the break, we were talking about the Larry Coyne case, 1975. I can't remember exactly what that is, but I was thinking, you know, for the new listeners to the show and people who are just getting interested in UFOs, do you know the basic story on what happened? I could say it, but I think I might miss some things or say it wrong, actually. For a lot of it.
Well, as I've said before, I know everything.
Okay, that's so, true. Yeah, yeah.
I believe it was 1973. It was October of 1973. Uh-huh. And it was a UH-1 helicopter. I've got like 1,500 hours, 1,400 hours in the UH-1 helicopter, 1,100 of it combat time. So I'm familiar with the aircraft and how it works. Mm-hmm. They were on a – they had been to Dayton, Ohio. I forget where they'd been in Ohio.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But they had gone for a flight physical, and they were flying back to their home station around Madison, Ohio. And as they were traveling along, flying along, minding their own business, one of the crewmen saw a light coming at them, and it approached on the left side. It went down the side of the aircraft and disappeared. And a few moments later, the other crewmen said that it was coming up on the right side, heading toward them. And that at that point, I think Jesse was flying the aircraft. Coyne was sitting there letting him do that. As the thing came close, he said, "I've got it." He took over control of the aircraft. The object sort of stopped over the helicopter, and big green object that they could see, and watched it for a minute. The aircraft seemed to be descending at that point. Their aircraft, the helicopter, seemed to be descending because Coyne didn't want to collide with this object. There's some kind of radio interference as well. They had been talking to the Mansfield Airport, and they lost radio communication with it. So they, because they were asking if there's other traffic in the area, meaning other aircraft in the area. The object then shot off, and as it did, Coyne noticed they were in a climb, and he couldn't arrest the climb. And I know what you do in a situation like that, you put the collective full down. And if that doesn't work, you roll off the throttle mm-hmm. to what was called the flight idle detent. And if that doesn't work, the last thing you do is kick the pedals out of trim, or the aircraft out of trim, so it would fall faster. That wasn't working. I don't know if you went through all those procedures or not. I had a situation where, you know, flying in a formation, I was in the slot position, and there were aircraft on each side of me and behind me, and we were descending into an LZ, and my aircraft was floating. And that's what I had to do. I, you know, rolled off the throttle. I had the collective pulled on and rolled off the throttle. I kicked the pedals out of trim. And as that happened, you know, I was able to stay in my position and fly. I couldn't break either way, which is what I would have done. And we got close to the ground, the lead flares out, and everything was okay. So they, you know, I speculate that they that Coyne had done the same thing, trying to get the aircraft to stop. He said he felt a thump. They were 3,500 feet. He felt a thump, and he was able to regain the control of the aircraft, flew on to their home station, landed, and made the report about what it was. Said the compass was spinning wildly. I think Jesse said they replaced it. They replaced it. It was a magnetic compass as opposed to ADF. And I think Jesse said, you know, we replaced the compass. But Coyne said we did that. And one of them said it didn't work properly still. I think Coyne said it's after they replaced it, it worked okay. Jesse was saying it didn't work properly the second time they replaced it because there was some kind of interference in the aircraft. And I know when you put a magnetic compass in an aircraft, you have to do what they call swinging the compass, which means you align on airfields. There's what's called a compass road. You set your aircraft down there, and you use that to align magnetic north so that you know exactly you know where the compass is, so it's magnetic north. And the compass was spinning. I think Jenny Zeidman learned that after they had replaced the compass, it worked okay. So, you know, another effect of being close to the UFO. There were some people on the ground that saw the green light and saw the helicopter and that sort of thing. So there were witnesses on the ground as well. So it wasn't just the air crew, but all the air crew, but other witnesses saw the thing as well. There was no radar return. But in today's world, with stealth aircraft, who cares? You know, that stealth aircraft kind of renders that the no radar return argument moot.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's kind of the basics of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you covered that really well. And yeah, that's a real good one, I think. And very scary. You know, you talked about that military. I forget what aircraft was where they merged, or it looked like they merged on radar, and you know, probably went into the lake. That's what reminded me of this, because, you know, it was almost like they were going to be, you know, abducted, the whole unit, you know, in a way. It was similar.
Well, there's any number of aircraft who have disappeared chasing UFOs. Mm-hmm. And there's other encounters with UFOs that cause some kind of problems with the aircraft. Interestingly, I've noticed, you know, we have the stories of cars being stalled by close approach of UFOs. Yeah. The engines are stalled, the lights fade out, and the radios fade away. We've had close approaches of UFOs to aircraft where it has affected the electronic systems, the avionics of the aircraft, and yet it doesn't stall the engines.
You think
back to the day the Earth stood still, where Michael Rennie is going to have to figure out some kind of demonstration of power. And Sam Jaffe said, well, a little demonstration. I don't want anybody to get hurt. And so he shut off all the electricity. Mm-hmm. But they said even the exceptions were interesting. You know, airplanes in flight, hospitals, things like that, you know, didn't lose their electrical power. It was just everybody else. And, you know, one of the things I think about is we don't have a case where an aircraft accident was caused by the electromagnetic effect. And I couch it in those terms specifically because there's the Australian case where the pilot disappeared. Oh, yeah. And, of course, the F-89 that disappeared as well. But you've got close approaches of UFOs that do affect the avionics and things like that, but don't shut down the engines. So that's kind of an interesting thing. The other, which reminded me of another. Here's another point as well. The electromagnetic effects that shut down the engines, the Condon Committee and others have said, well, we know of no mechanism to suppress an engine working, you know, that way. And then when the UFO leaves, the engine begins to work properly again. But I went back and I studied several hundred of these cases of engines being stalled. And what I saw was, a lot of times they said, well, the engine worked properly after the UFO left, but it didn't say it started spontaneously. And you look closer, you find more cases as well. Once the UFO is gone, I was able to start the car.
Yeah.
So they started the engine. So it's not like the engine comes back spontaneously, but the driver had to take some action to get the get the engine started. There are cases where they say it started spontaneously, but the majority of the cases seem to be that the driver took some kind of action to start the engine. Even though the radio came back, the lights brightened up again, the driver had to do something to start the engine of the vehicle. So that's, you know, kind of one of the things that I've noticed as you study some of these cases in depth.
Yeah, you know, I never thought of those cases. Always really interest me too, and actually the fact that the engine and the airplane, I never thought of that why does everything else get affected but not that? And, you know, I had mentioned on the show a couple of times over in Russia, this it's basically my girlfriend's father, you know, had an encounter where everyone in this mountain pass, their engines stalled, and they went over to the side of the road and got out and watched this cigar-shaped thing, you know, with portholes float over. All the engines were stalled in every car, and after the thing went over, everyone was able to start up their car and go on. You know, so it's those cases just fascinate me. And
well,
there's a lot of them.
Len Stringfield talked about his encounter with it. It said it started the engines of the C-47 to operate roughly, and the co-pilot said, you know, prepare to ditch. And then, of course, the three objects left and the engines smoothed out and they were able to continue their trip to Japan. This is right after the end of World War II, by the way. So, and they were leaving from Iwo Jima to go to Japan right after the end of the war. And, but the aircraft didn't crash and the things moved away so that, the engines smoothed out. So you know, I look at all of that sort of thing as a way of, is there patterns to sightings and things like that. One of the things I've noticed and something I was putting together, there was a sighting in Cherry Creek, New York in 1965. And they found, after the UFO was gone, they found some oily-like substance in the fields. And they found some sort of like skid marks in the pastures. And I thought, you know, there's a number of cases where the physical evidence like that has been found, but nobody's ever linked them before. You know, and it got me to thinking, do we need a big database? I mean, a big spreadsheet where you can quickly look at that sort of thing. But we mentioned the Flatwoods case earlier because of the Project Blue Book. In the real case, they did find some skid marks on the ground and some oily substance left behind. So we've got this case from 1952, and now we have a case from 1965 where the same sort of thing is gone. There was another case called the Tin Can Man from Minnesota, I think also in 1965, where they found an oily substance. And there's another case where they found the skid marks and the oily substance. And I can't find the case because I didn't write it down at the time because I just noted it, but I can't find it. I'll have to go back through the files to see if I can find the specific case. But and then I started looking for cases like that where you've got skid marks and, like 2 feet long, 2 foot, 3 foot long marks, maybe side by side, parallel, or one after another, that sort of thing in the fields where the UFOs were seen. And, I don't know if anybody's ever put that kind of thing together. Was it Ted Phillips had done an analysis of landing traces where he put it together. I think he had 5,000 cases.
Right.
And he said,
yeah,
if you tell me the landing gear, I'll tell you the shape of the object. So that, that was kind of an interesting thing for him to say. Or if you tell me the shape of the object, I'll tell you the kind of landing gear it had. Huh. And so he was able to deduce a pattern between the shape of the object and the landing gear pattern that you would see if there was landing gear patterns left behind. And he had about 4,000 cases. One of the problems that we'd run into with some of those landing trace cases is oftentimes the craft isn't seen on the ground. The craft is seen in proximity. And so there's an assumption that there's a correlation between the markings on the ground and the craft seen in the sky. And that may not be a valid scientific conclusion to draw.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, as I said, Phillips was able to deduce the landing gear based on the shape of the craft and vice versa. So it's kind of an interesting thing that I think we need more of in ufology if we're going to move us to a more scientific realm, is to look at some of these cases that may be widely separated in time and distance, but have some of the same physical evidence attributes that maybe would help us understand things a little bit better.
Yeah, I think things like that should be noted. It reminds me of, I know there's pictures of a very unusual craft that are something like 20 years apart. I can't remember, one's in France, and I just can't remember where the other one was taken. And it looks like the exact same craft.
McMinnville, Oregon.
Maybe it is McMinnville. Yeah,
but the problem with that, I think the French picture was taken in 1954, so it's only it's like 4 years apart.
Oh, it's 4 years. Okay.
But there's no good source for the French picture.
Ah. Oh,
okay. We know who took the pictures in McMinnville.
Mm-hmm.
We know all that information about it, but with the French picture, we don't have all of that information, so it becomes a little bit problematic. But that's exactly the sort of thing. And that's the other thing. How come when we see pictures of UFOs, of course, what we have to remember is about 99% of them were taken by teenage boys, and 99% of those are hoaxes.
Mm-hmm.
But we do not have pictures that where the same object kind of reappears I was going to say a regular pattern, but not necessarily regularly, but reappears in different places at different times. We don't really have any good photographs like that. I think one of the problems is, of course, back when UFOs first began visiting us, as we say in the modern era, not everybody had cameras. Nobody even traveled with cameras, and people were afraid of burning up film for something that might not come out, so they didn't take pictures. Unlike the ubiquitous cell phone with its 26 megapixel cameras embedded in it, but they don't see the UFOs because they're busy looking at the phone as opposed up in the sky. So, yeah, that was the one thing that I've always wanted is a photographic case where you've got independent witnesses at two or three different locations shooting the same object. And if you had that, you could get good information about the size of the object, the height that it was, and the speed it was moving, because you can triangulate from that point. But we don't have a case like that. We've got cases where we got people in multiple locations seeing a similar thing. Levelland, Texas in 1957, stalling the car engines. And you've got Witness, I know Witness is in at least 13 separate locations reporting the same thing independently to the sheriff or the police department in Levelland, Texas. But by 1957, everybody was so busy arguing with the Air Force about what was real and what was not that nobody was bothering to investigate the case in depth. And we would have much better information had we not had those sort of arguments. Kehoe said, well, there were nine people who saw the object. And the Air Force says, nah, there was only three people. And you go through the Air Force file and the documentation available, and you find people at 13 separate locations that saw this thing and had it interact with the environment. And there's now information that suggests the sheriff, who said, well, I saw the red light in the distance, I didn't get close, actually got close enough for it to stall his car engine. And that's based on what his family said. But he had also told him, well, the Air Force asked me not to talk about it. And oftentimes the Air Force would ask people, well, you know, don't talk about your sighting, not threatening them with any way, just asking them not to talk, and they wouldn't. They clammed up at that point. Sheriff Wilcox from Roswell said that when reporters called him after the events, he said, well, I'm working with those boys out at the base, and I can't really talk about it. Didn't say anything about being threatened or any of that. Just said, I can't talk about it. So, you know, we've got those problems in ufology as well, which is kind of a divergence from where we were going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hey, I've had a couple of questions come in. The chat room's quite active tonight, and I haven't really looked for any questions in there yet. I did catch one earlier that I wrote down, but someone just emailed me earlier and asked what you thought about the Aurora, Texas case, which I thought was... I don't know if I want to use the word debunked, but explained.
It's a hoax. Yeah. Yeah, it's a hoax. It's a hoax.
Well, it was explained, right? It was a hoax. It was just a hoax.
Nothing happened. Nothing happened. But here's the interesting part that people don't realize. Number one is the reporter who initially reported it did it because he wanted people to become interested in Aurora, Texas. That was his hometown, and he was trying to get people interested in Texas because the railroad had bypassed Aurora. But the other thing is, within 10 years of this event, which took place in April 17th of 1897, within 10 years of that, there were two books written about the history of Wise County, Aurora's in Wise County. Neither of those books mentioned this event. Huh. I'm thinking if there was a crash of some kind of bizarre ship, an airship, in Aurora, Texas in 1897, without the CIA and the Air Force and everybody trying to suppress the information, it would have been mentioned in those books. Wow, here's something interesting that happened in Aurora back in 1897, and it's not mentioned there. And that, to me, is the real killer for the Aurora, Texas case. Not to mention other facts that came out. T.J. Weems, the signal officer, mm-hmm. that they quote in a lot of the stories, he turned out to be the local blacksmith. Mm. And for some reason, in 1897, when you thought signal officer, you were thinking intelligence. Signal officer is he's interested in communications as opposed to gathering intelligence. But nothing has ever been found. My blog, I have pictures of the graveyard where the 97 airship are hoaxes. The great, great Alexander Hamilton calf napping turned out to be a hoax. And Jerry Clark interviewed the daughter of Alexander Hamilton. Yeah, not the guy killed by being kidnapped, and then they found the remains of it in a field like it had been dropped from the sky, which were really interesting in the days of cattle mutilations. But Jerry Clark talked to the daughter, and she said, no, it didn't happen. My father belonged to a liars club, and they were making stuff up. But then Eddie Bullard found a story in a newspaper from 1897 in Atchison, Kansas, I think it was. Anyway, he found a story in there where Hamilton and sent a letter and says, I made the whole thing up. So you've got, you know, the documentation, the story was made up. So an awful lot of the stories, you go back and you look at the airship stories, there's a lot of them where the people are talking about they're building airships so they can go to Cuba to bomb the Spanish, because this is just prior to the Spanish-American War in 1898.
Yeah.
There was a wonderful story that I read in the Cedar Rapids Gazette and had a story, article of the thing that had crashed in Waterloo, Iowa, or landed, emergency landed there, and the professor who had built the thing was killed, and they were talking about it. And there was an illustration in the Cedar Rapids Gazette that I had, of course, used a number of times with the permission of the Gazette. And I did a book called, I think it's the Alien Mysteries book, and one of the editor's jobs was to find photographs for the book. The guy found a photograph of this thing that had landed in Waterloo, Iowa. He had a photograph of it. Hmm. And so it appears in the book, and I put it up on my blog too, so you can see the illustration that was done by the Gazette and the actual photograph of the thing. But the one of the guys was recognized as a Waterloo resident, and the whole thing collapsed at that point because they realized it was a hoax. Get your garbage off our fairgrounds type thing. But what fascinated me was there was an actual photograph. And wow. I never thought to go to Waterloo and look at the Courier to see if there was a photograph of the thing, because there was a photograph of it. Kind of blew me away.
Yeah. Along those lines, are there, because what happens is sometimes once a story is out there, it's out there so long that people just take it as fact, without really looking into it. Are there some other fairly sizable stories like that that you're aware of that are, like, for instance, I'm trying to remember, it was an early one that was claimed to be a hoax, right after the Kenneth Arnold sighting or just before it.
Maury Island.
Yeah, Maury Island. Is that a hoax? Do you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. See, there's a couple like that that end up being hoaxes, and that's another one that almost is down in, UFO lore as a solid case.
If you go back and the wonderful thing with the internet is you can check all of this stuff out now. And what you have to do is look at multiple sources. You can't find a single source and read about Maury Island and determine, well, that's the truth. You have to look at multiple sources and see what they have to say and compare all that information and documentation and then decide for yourself whether it's a hoax or not. I believe Maury Island is a hoax. It turns out the harbor patrolman, which gives them some sort of status, were not harbor patrolmen. They were, in fact, salvage operators in Puget Sound, and they would take their boat around and they would pull logs out of Puget Sound or wreckage they could find out of Puget Sound and take it in and sell it. This is the story of they saw six donut-shaped UFOs flying in formation, and one of them was spewing metal out because it seemed to have been in some kind of trouble, and the metal fell on their boat and it injured the guy's son, Harold Dawes' son, I think it was.
Killed the dog.
And killed the dog. But people have found Harold Dahl's son. He said, never happened. You go to the hospital and you can't find any records of the kid being treated. Hmm. All those sorts of things. You have to look at all of that sort of thing. The sad thing about it is Kenneth Arnold was asked to investigate the case by Ray Palmer, who was a editor of a science fiction magazine, Amazing Stories, I think it was. And they had been doing the Shaver mystery, which was this idea that the flying saucers came out of the inner Earth, and there were good robots and there were bad robots, and they were fighting some kind of war, and all the bad stuff that happened on Earth, the surface of the Earth, was the result of these evil robots. And when the flying saucer thing started, Palmer thought, validation for my stories about this sort of thing. And so he wanted Kenneth Arnold to investigate the Maury Island story when he learned about it. Arnold went to Tacoma, Washington to interview the guys. He called two Air Force officers who had been there, Army Air Force's officers actually, who had come up to investigate his sighting, Davidson and I can't remember the other guy's name, Brown. He called them to help him with the investigation. They got up there, interviewed Dahl and Chrisman, who was the other harbor patrolman, and realized it was a hoax right away, and the metal that they had recovered was just kind of a useless slag. They didn't want to take the samples back to their Fort Hamilton Air Force Base. But they were pressed on it. They got in their B-25 to fly back to Hamilton, and the plane crashed. So, of course, then there's all speculation that the aircraft was shot down to keep the samples out of the hands of the military and that sort of thing. Before they took off to go back home, they had talked to the operations officer at the base where they landed the B-25 and said, nah, they said it was a hoax. They didn't say anything to Arnold because they didn't want to embarrass him. They liked Arnold, and they thought Arnold had a good sighting, and Arnold was just out of his depth, and so that Maury Island turned out to be a hoax. When you began talking about it, the sighting that came to mind was the Chiles Whitted sighting from 1948, where the two airline pilots saw a cigar-shaped craft shoot by them with a lighted cockpit and square windows along the side, and the first reaction I think of Hynek was that he sounded like a bolide to him. And now they didn't believe it. A lot of the military got into it and thought this was a really solid sighting, and it was kind of one of the precipitating events for the great estimate of the situation that we hear about in ufology. In 1968, I think the Zond 4 re-entered. It was a Soviet spacecraft, and it fell and it broke up. Most people knew what it was, saw what it was, but a lot of people thought it was some kind of a cigar-shaped craft with square windows along the side. And what happens is the thing begins to break up apart, and it strings out. You get this idea that it's a cigar shape with windows along the side. And some of the drawings that were made of the Zond 4 reentry, in which we know it was, resembled to a great extent the drawings made by Chiles and Whitted. I think that case, which was, I guess, one of the foundations of the UFO field, is now explained as a bolide. There was on YouTube something called Meteor Compilation. I think it's 3 minutes and 19 seconds that I found. And what it was, somebody put together meteor falls that had been recorded on video. And you look at some of those and you're thinking, as a thing breaks up and the lights begin to string out, if you just catch a glimpse of it, well, in psychology, something called gestalt, where you put all these things together in your mind. You see an image, even though there's no image there. You, yes. you try to group the whole thing together. So if you just get a quick look at it, it's going to look like a lighted cockpit with square windows along the side. And I think that's a legitimate explanation for Chiles Whitted, which does not diminish the UFO field at all. It's just that here we have an explanation for this case that was basically unexplained for the longest time, at least in the world of the ufology. The Air Force wrote it off as a bolide, then changed it, and then wrote it off as a bolide again. But I think the point is in that respect, the Air Force got that one right. Mm-hmm. They were right on that one, but that's a case that was kind of a classic UFO case that we now have, I think, a legitimate explanation for. So we can look at those sort of things, and that's the thing we have to do, is go back and look at these things carefully. When you get back to 1897, you have to remember that the reporting there was a little bit looser than it is today. And then I think, fake news, and I mean, we see example after example that in today's world where the reporters just run off on tangents without knowing the full story. And after days, we begin to filter things out and realize what's going on. But in 1897, it was the Hearst Corporation was pushing for a war with Spain. And when the Maine blew up in the harbor, they pushed the story that it was sabotage, and that kind of dragged us into that war. So you had a lot of that, and you had a lot of the stuff where the reporters were making things up. And the great airship is a prime example of that, that the reporters would make up the stories to have something in the newspaper. There were telegraphers in Iowa who kept the story alive. One telegrapher in a town would say, well, it's over here, and it's heading toward the next town. And pretty soon the telegrapher there would come on and say, yeah, it's over here, now it's heading to a different town. And so they would kind of track it around the state of Iowa, but it was all made up by the telegraphers. They're just having a little bit of fun.
Now, I remember that was the late 19th century?
That was 1897, Great Airship of 1897. Jerry Clark and I disagree on this. I think it was all bogus. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was ever an airship. Jerry Clark thinks there was a core of good sightings that came out of California in 1896 that kind of sparked this. I think Jerry's wrong on that, and Jerry thinks I'm wrong. So, it's one of those things where we disagree, but we can disagree as gentlemen and say, well, we'll have to agree to disagree. But I think the 1897 airship is basically the figment of a lot of people's imagination and a lot of hoaxing going on. People just having a good time with the stories.
Right, right. You know, one thing I forgot to explain at the beginning of the show, someone just asked in the chat room, is why is my show Monday night? And why is it later? And I never even mentioned that. So, yeah, it was you.
It's my fault. My fault.
Yeah, but that's okay. I look at it this way. It's always great having you on, and I don't mind accommodating you in this certain circumstance. So, yeah.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
But Tuesday nights, the 7 o'clock hour is just, I can't do it at 7 o'clock on Tuesday nights.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was my fault, and I, you know, if we could have done it an hour later or whatever, that would have been fine. But, you know, Tuesday night just didn't work for me, so.
Yeah, yeah.
And I appreciate the accommodation, too, by the way.
Yeah.
Doing this for me, helping me out.
Well, it seems like we have a lot more people on YouTube. Maybe it's a good time spot. Maybe you helped me discover something. I'm not sure. Someone wrote early on in when we first started the show, they wanted you to, and I think you've talked about this on a show, maybe not the last one, the time you were on before, but what your thoughts are about Roswell now. That's what the question is.
Yay, give me a chance to promote a book. I did a book called Roswell in the 21st Century, which is available right now this minute on Kindle. You could be reading it in 30 seconds. But what I did was I looked at the Roswell case as a cold case, gone back to all the witnesses, gone back to the documentation, gone back to everything that I could find on Roswell, looking at it as dispassionately as I possibly could, and then put it all together in the book. And I think that while in the early 1990s, a lot of us thought that Roswell was a very robust case with a lot of good stuff, since that time, a lot of the witnesses have blown up. A lot of the witnesses proved out to be less than candid with their descriptions of what they saw. We haven't been able to find any documentation. I'm concerned that we couldn't find a diary. Somebody kept a private diary that explained some of this stuff. Although Denise Marcel and some of the Marcel family said that their grandfather, Jesse Marcel Sr., did keep a diary, and it's in their hands, and they're doing various testing so that when the skeptics say, well, you guys just wrote this last week, they can say, no, here's the evidence that show that this diary was completed in the 1947-1948 time frame. We did find one diary kept by Ruth Barnett, which has to do with the Plains of San Augustine crash that was brought into the Roswell case. No mention of anything on the Plains of San Augustine in that diary, which was very disturbing, suggesting that, you know, well, we got the time frame wrong or nothing happened for some reason. Barney Barnett was spinning the tale. But we never found anything like that. So I looked at all of this and put it together as best I could in the book Roswell in the 21st Century. Looked in depth at the Project Mogul explanation, which I am absolutely astonished that we have a document written by the man who was in charge of Project Mogul, Albert Crary, Dr. Crary, who says on the flight that supposedly landed on the Brazel Ranch and explains the whole thing, wrote on the date June 4th, no flight today. Yeah. Excuse me, doesn't that pretty well rule out Mogul, I think? You know, that sort of thing. I looked at the MJ-12 documents in depth, looked at a lot of these sorts of things in depth, tried to put the story together at best I could, based on, as it is a cold case. So my feeling is it's not nearly as robust as it was. Some of the witnesses aren't as good as we thought they were. Some of the evidence is not panned out like we hoped it would. And when we get right down to it, we're left with no explanation for what fell at Roswell. And that's, I can lean toward the extraterrestrial because I can find no terrestrial explanation for it. But by the same token, that may be a leap that I do not want to take without some better evidence for it. So where we are right now is we've got some very interesting stories about the Roswell case, and we got to look at all of that stuff. We have no explanation for what fell at Roswell. Is that sufficient to take us to the extraterrestrial? I think the person reading the book or studying the case has to make that determination for himself or herself.
Uh-huh. Well, another thing besides diaries, people write letters, you know, and I'm surprised a letter has never surfaced that someone wrote, you know, either from the base, you know, to a loved one or whatever, say, hey, Mom, you know, you can't believe what I saw or something like that.
And yeah, I've still got all the letters that I wrote home from Vietnam. in 68 and 69, which gives you an idea of how old I am, if my picture didn't give it away. But I have those letters, and I know my wife's got the letters that her father wrote home to her mother from World War II. Mm-hmm. So families keep those sorts of things. And the best we can look at is Inez Wilcox, who was the wife of the sheriff, George Wilcox, in Roswell in 1947, and Wilcox was involved. And she did a story, she wrote it for the Reader's Digest, I guess, called 4 Years in the County Jail. And the gag was, of course, she was a matron for the jail when her husband was the sheriff. So they weren't incarcerated, they were running the jail. And in there, she put the story of seeing the crash and the little men. The problem with it is it's not dated. Mm. We don't know when she wrote it. And it was an addition that she added to the story after the original story had been written. It never got published, but it was, I think it was like page 8A or something like this. And there was this paragraph about the UFO, the flying saucer crash. But it's not dated. I found out that she had passed away in 1989. Well, the Roswell Incident book came out in 1980. So it wasn't like, she could have been contaminated from that source or some of the documentaries. I think In Search Of did something on Roswell in the early 1980s. So it's possible that she had seen that. But that, you know, we've got that document. It's interesting, but without a date on it, we're just kind of, well, you know, she could have written it long after the story became well known in the public arena.
Also, when you were talking about the Marcells' supposed diary, it would be very hard to prove that that diary is from 1947 because there could be so many, there are, I just see so many different ways people even fake things as early as Abraham Lincoln autographs and things like that. There's ways to find Civil War paper. There's ways to find, 1940s diaries that are empty. And, you know, I mean, it's going to be a real tough one to prove, I think.
Well, but then you can look at the ink,
yeah,
and you can look for anachronisms. There are things that you can be done to validate the diary. I don't think the Marcell family would participate in any kind of hoax.
Oh,
like
I know.
That.
I'm just talking about the skeptics. The skeptics.
But I think, I think the ink can be formulation of the ink can be.
That
examined.
That's true. And if it is ink, if it's pencil, then, you know, that's a little tougher. You know, graphite's been around, you know.
But you can take a look at the way the graphite is on the page and things like that to see if it's aged properly. So there are things you can do. The big thing is, talking in that arena, the De La Peña diary from the Alamo, which is the one where the story that Davy Crockett surrendered comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, you know, they looked at the ink, they looked at all of that sort of thing, and they were unable to establish the provenance of the diary. So you can believe that the De La Peña diary is an authentic document from the Texas Revolution, or it was a modern forgery, you know, depending on what you want to believe. And so we understand that. On the other side of that coin, we had the great faked George W. Bush documents that got Dan Rather in trouble. And they were able to establish that the documents were modern forgery.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Wow.
And he just went down the tube on. They wanted to believe so badly that George W. Bush had not fulfilled his duty properly. And the documentation that they had that proved it just the documents they had were copies. They didn't have the real documents. And at that point, you know, you're dead in the water and trying to validate this stuff. And after they got called on it, then they began to look at it specifically. Peter Tytel, who, by the way, was the first person approached by Stan Friedman to validate the MJ-12 documents and believes them to be a hoax, was called by CBS to validate these papers. And by the time he got back to him, he was out of town or something. By the time he got back to him, they had found other document examiners to look at it. But Peter Tytel was originally approached by CBS to validate those documents. So now we got Peter Tytel, who's tied into MJ-12 and the great George W. Bush document forgery fiasco.
Wow. Wow.
Which, by the way, I should point out, does not mean that George W. Bush fulfilled his National Guard service properly. It means the documents they were going to prove it were forgeries, and they couldn't find other documents to support the allegations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm going to attempt to take a phone call now. As I mentioned earlier, I'm on this little tiny Mac computer, and I'm not really sure if I'm going to be able to, but that phone number is going up on the line right now. If someone wants to call in and ask a question, that number is 603-967-4030. I get calls all the time off hours, and someone called the other day and asked to speak to Stanton Friedman because I did a show with him several months ago. So they watch it on YouTube and watch the number come up. So this is showtime only. This phone number is active showtime only. And so if someone wants to call in, go ahead.
Would they like Stan's phone number? I have it. I'm sure he'd appreciate me giving it out.
Yeah, that's right. Let's give it over live. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there's other questions up on the chat. And let's see. I just want to see if I can pull up anything right now. The direction that you think until we have, you know, either someone call in or I find a question up here. What do you think the direction is going pretty good as far as ufology goes, or what's your thoughts on it? You know, some people, you say they should drain the swamp, you know, on and on and on. But what do you think in general we have a call coming in. It looks like I'm not able to join the call. So we're going to have to take down the call number. I'm sorry. I'm using a different computer, and I thought it would work. No call tonight. If you have any questions, please just put that in the chat room, and I'll try to get to that. And so I was asking Kevin, what do you think the direction of ufology is going in general?
Oh, I'd like to say I'm hopeful, but I see too much nonsense being embraced. There was a woman on a radio program a year ago or so that decided that her research had proven that none of us had been into Iraq. We had actually been to Mars.
Oh, I knew that.
And,
yeah.
And fought on Mars, and then we were brainwashed when we came back to be convinced we were in Iraq. And people buy that nonsense. There's these guys claiming to be time travelers. You know, if you're a time traveler, give me the lottery numbers, please. Thank you. Tell me what stock to buy tomorrow. You know, what's the price of gold going to do? Anything that I could become rich on? And they embraced this nonsense. One guy claimed that he had been abducted as a teenager, fought on Mars for 20 years, and returned home like 15 minutes later after he disappeared through some kind of time manipulation. And I'm thinking, people buy this crap?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they do. But it's been that way since the beginning. You had the contactees with their nonsensical stuff. George Adamski was, his pals on Venus. I'm thinking, what kind of metal do they make their spaceships out of on Venus?
Right, 800 degrees there.
Doesn't it get really, really hot?
Yeah.
What kind of air conditioning bill do they have? and I see that stuff, and I think, you know, people just don't apply any logic to what they're being told. Some of the stories are just so outrageous, and people say, yeah, that's true. And the next thing you know, they're spouting that stuff off. And that's kind of worrisome. And I know that there's been people waiting for the old guard and ufology to die off so the young whippersnappers can take over and get us to the answers. But I'm thinking, if they don't have any better powers of critical thinking than they've displayed, they're going to take it off into a really weird place.
Well, I think a lot of that is the people that latch on to that are looking for something to latch on to. I think there's a lot more logical, you know, like the flat earthers or, you know, any of that. But I think there's a lot of people out there that are more, you know, well, at least the people that listen to the show, I get a lot of email. They like the fact that I try to follow logic as much as possible and try to keep, you know, away from the fringe as much as possible. So I think there's just a segment.
But on the other side. But on the other side of that coin, you know, I come on your program, for example, and I try to explain logically with evidence what has happened and what's going on, and then I'm attacked and vilified. Well, you're nothing but a shill for the Air Force. You're some kind of special agent for the Air Force with a mission to a disinformation mission.
You know, yeah, I've actually had recently. Someone write me about you, yes. Something and, similar, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, there you go. And yeah. But the point is, if you look at the evidence and where it goes, I go where the evidence goes.
That's where you should go.
And if the evidence doesn't take me there, I'm not going to go there. If I wanted to be the number one UFO guy, with Stan moving out of the way, I would brace everything. Yep, cattle are being mutilated by UFOs. Yep, crop circles are real. Yep, people are being abducted wholesale. You buy into all of it. But yes, I was truly on Mars. Now that the 10 years has been since I, or 15 years since I got back, my security clearance has expired. I can tell you about the big war on Mars. And it was brilliant because what they did was, if we were to call, email or buy online something from Walmart, we would get it within a week. Talk about the distribution system. They get stuff from Walmart to Mars in a week, for crying out loud. We could call home with no time delay, you know, rather than, you know, 8 or 9 minutes between wherever we happen, the orbits happen to match up, wherever it was, maybe as much as 20 minutes. We could call home with instantaneous, you know, all of that stuff, not a problem. And so, you know, I just cannot embrace all of that stuff. If I've got an explanation for a case, I've got to give it. You want a case that's great? Look at Levelland. There's no explanation for that, and you've got the UFO seen by everybody. That's a wonderful case that suggests some kind of visitation.
What? When is that one?
November of 1957. You know? There's great cases out there that are lost in the noise of the crap cases that people want to promote that just make no sense and don't fit into the UFO phenomenon properly.
Well, let's enlighten us on that case in particular, if you would.
What, Levelland?
Yeah.
November 2nd, 1957, Pedro Saucedo, who was a Korean War veteran, I mentioned that because Korean War veterans deserve some recognition, had his truck stalled. Object landed near him, the lights faded, the truck stalled. He was panicked, jumped out of the truck, rolled underneath it. The passenger sat there staring at the UFO. It took off. His truck started. He went and it's not clear whether he called the sheriff or he visited the sheriff. But people ignored him, didn't believe his story. Not long after that, other people began having similar experiences with a UFO approaching them, the car dying, the lights going out. There were two farmers in Pettit, Texas, who were running two combines. They both died at the same time with the UFO approached closely. So you've got people at 13 separate locations talking about these sorts of interactions with the environment. The sheriff goes out looking for it. The original story was he saw a streak of light in the distance, but the family says, no, he got a lot closer and his car stalled out. There was information that there was a landing trace case. It was burned circle on a ranch close to Levelland, Texas, that the sheriff saw and went out to take a look at that. If we had investigated that case in 1957 properly, rather than Air Force NCO, who investigated some most of a day in Levelland, talking to a few of the people, the Air Force wrote it off as ball lightning, a phenomenon they couldn't even prove existed in 1957. So they explained an unknown phenomenon with another unknown phenomenon. And everybody said, yeah, ball lightning works for me. Ball lightning is very small and very short-lived and very rare. But it's a case with all of the UFOs, the UFO interacting with the environment. You had lots of witnesses independently reporting to the police and the sheriff. You had law enforcement officers seeing the thing. This would be a case that would have been great. 2 hours later, I think it was, something is seen at White Sands Missile Range by a couple of MPs there. I talked to one of the MPs, a guy named Glenn Toy, told me that the Air Force explanation of it being the moon didn't work because they saw it land 100 yards away and then take off. The next day, two more MPs saw a similar thing. So you've got a series of sightings that take place over about a 12-hour period around Levelland, Texas, where the UFO is seen by lots of different people and interacts with the environment. Great case.
Wow.
But then you look at Giles Whitted, for example, which we talked about a little bit earlier. I think there's a legitimate explanation. I'm not going to ignore what is a legitimate explanation for this case based on the evidence, especially when we've got a similar case from 1968 that is explainable by things breaking up in the atmosphere as they return to Earth. So, you know, you've got to take a look at all of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And but if I wanted to be the number one UFO guy, yeah, Roar, Texas, yeah, alien spacecraft crashed there. Yes, I'm on board. I'm on board. Well, in fact, I was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and now that I'm out, I can tell you, I saw the bodies at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I was right there in the hangar with them and looked down at them, me and Corso. Oh, he was at Fort Riley, I'm sorry, at Fort Riley. But, you know, you've got to go where the evidence takes you and release your belief structure and what you want to believe and look at where the evidence takes you.
Yeah. They're very well said. Very well said. In the chat room, someone wanted you to talk about, I don't think you had any connection to this case, but the JAL 1628, you know, over Alaska, that case, which I think is a really fantastic case. But
it's a great case.
Yeah.
I actually FOIA'd a couple of radar operations on that to see if I could determine.
Oh, really?
A little bit more about the radar.
Uh-huh.
And got a quick response from the Air Force on that. What I was trying to do is a lot of times the radar facilities feed the radar information to different entities like the FAA or the Air Force. The Air Force puts its own discrimination on the radar returns. The FAA puts different discrimination on it to weed out the mundane like birds and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got a great case. You've got pilots who have seen the thing for a long time. What is more important about that is the reaction to the guy lost his flying job after reporting the UFO. But I don't think there's a good explanation for that case, and I think it's a wonderful case. With the only bad thing is they didn't get a good picture. They had cameras, they just didn't take pictures. I don't know. But in those sorts of circumstances, and if you're the pilot, sometimes it's really hard to worry about taking pictures of something if you're trying to fly the airplane at the same time. But they did the sort of thing you'd expect them to do in an attempt to identify what it was, and they were unable to do so. So that's a very good case as well. I wrote about it in one of, I think, the Government UFO Files book. I think I wrote about that in there, and at that point I did some FOIA work into the Air Force and that sort of thing.
From what I understand, NICAP was able to help that pilot get his
Richard Haynes.
Right, Richard Haynes. Yeah, he was able to
get his flying job back. He'd been demoted to a desk, and he did manage to get back into a flying job. But that also kind of underscores that, well, if you see a UFO, you may lose your flying job.
Yeah,
which would inhibit people from talking. Well, I didn't see any of that. Now, wasn't it in the Close Encounters where they asked the airline pilot, "You want to report a UFO?" I said, "No, I don't think so."
Yeah.
You know, I didn't see anything.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I understand, but I think that's loosening up. We've seen evidence of that recently with the Arizona FAA situation, also Oregon and the Irish. Well, Irish, that's Ireland, a whole different thing. But still, there's been a couple of cases where the FAA has been very responsive. At least I had Tyler Rogaway, who writes for the War Zone, and he was able to get information right away, even recordings. So it seems like they're loosening up a little bit.
On the JAL case, I talked to John Callahan, who was the FAA investigator on that, and I got his, you know, after he'd given his talk at the citizen hearing in Washington, D.C. in 2013, I actually got the transcript of his remarks. He gave them to me. So when I did my report on it for the book, I had his remarks from his talk, and that the things that he learned, because they had the radar track of the object, and they could put together everything in a timeline. And the one thing he did say is that the CIA guy showed up and says, "Ah, we weren't here. You know, we didn't hear this. We're not here."
Yeah.
But you know, so that's a good case. And I talked to John Callahan for a while about it, and got his the transcript of his remarks. So I have, you know, some good information on that that came from another one of the people who was directly involved in the investigation.
Right. And just we only have 3 minutes left. Just for, again, we have a lot of new listeners, and you know, someone has written in the chat room, "Oh, I'm going to look into that case or whatever." So can you give the overall of this case, what happened?
Which
the JAL 1628.
Well, it was just the pilot and the crew of, I think it was a cargo plane as opposed to a passenger
plane. Right.
It's, yep. Had seen the object, kept track of it. They made a number of turns to see if they could get any more information or how it reacted to their turns, and eventually it disappeared in the distance, and they flew on and completed their mission. But there's the radar information about it. I mean, if you go to the internet, look up JAL 1628, and you'll get a lot of information. I think it's in, I can't remember if it's in the government UFO files book that I did. You can go there and take a look at that, which is available on Kindle. You could be looking at it in 20 minutes or 20 seconds. I don't believe I did anything on my blog about it, though. I don't think that's on the blog yet. So
yeah, and that was really an amazing thing. It was looked like the shape of a walnut or something like that.
Yeah. Oh
and
yeah.
It was
yeah.
huge
And they had it on the weather radar, which is important because the weather radar is on the aircraft, and then the radar on the ground tracked the thing. So you've got two separate 8 radar returns of it as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Two independent radars showing this object, so there was something real there.
And they did that big circle, and the thing, thing followed along, which is something else. And I don't know. It must have scared the heck out of them, I would think. You know, how do you explain something like that? It's such a mystery.
Yeah, I don't understand why in today's world people would be frightened by this, but I read all kinds of cases where the first reaction is fear, and I'm thinking,
I think flying, I would have fear of flying more than anything else. You know, if I was a pilot flying a plane and I saw something, you just feel vulnerable up in the sky, you know? I think.
I'm not sure I agree with that, because being a combat pilot, we saw lots of stuff in the sky.
So
lots
Kevin,
of lights in the sky.
Yeah, yep.
Called tracers.
So, if you would give out your blog spot, and how people can get your books and all that, Amazon, right?
Oh, Amazon Kindle has the book, so you can get them immediately. The blog is www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com. There's a lot of stuff on there. There's information about the programs that I have, the program I hosted as well. And one of the ones that just recently was Treasure Quest, and about how much reality is involved in that program. They got a lot of people looking into it, and I had one of the guys on the from the show on my program, so you can go listen to what he has to say about Treasure Quest. But that's at www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com. The books are at Kindle. Just type my name in there and you can find it, and there's usually some information about it, so you can just determine which book you want. The latest book was Encounter in the Desert, which is about the Lonnie Zamora sighting in 1964, which is a good sighting. Mm-hmm. Yay, Lonnie.
Yeah,
you know, that's one that I don't debunk.
yeah, that's a great one. All right, Kevin. Hey, thanks so much. Pleasure as always.
Thank you very much. Appreciate all the time.
Oh, you bet. And we'll have you on again as a regular guest, I'm sure. So you take care.
Okay.
All right.
You too. Thank you much.
All right. Thank you. All right, everyone. So that's it for our show. And let's see. Next week, we have another interesting show. And that is, we have a ufologist from, I think he's Beijing, China. He's actually a Chinese ufologist. He speaks English, a little bit of an accent, but he's very understandable, and I think you're going to really love the show next week. His name is, he likes to be called Chuck, so that's what we're going to call him, Chuck Fei, and he will be on next week. I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show and behind the scenes, and you, the listener. And I also want to thank the people that support the show. All right, everyone, so remember to keep your eyes to the sky.